You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Robert Bound.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Beijing plays host to Mahmoud Abbas, followed by Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll assess the state of China's new role, not just as the ultimate geopolitical bed and breakfast, but also as a new voice of international diplomacy.
Also ahead, we meet a man whose background in comedy helped him turn his talents to writing novels.
Plus, we'll find out what's been making the news agenda in Tokyo, and we get the latest from the Berlin art scene.
We have a wonderful group of international collectors, curators, critics, artists coming to town for this event and see the gallery shows, because it's the idea was to do something that is not an art fair, to bring the people back in the galleries.
All that plus we'll play some music too, all to come here in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the latest world news headlines from Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Malaysia's opposition leader has condemned Sunday's election result. The ruling Barisan Nasional, or National Front, which has ruled for 56 years, saw off the challenge of the opposition alliance, but it's not clear whether it will have a strong enough mandate to continue with its reform programme. Opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim says the election was fraudulent and the Election Commission had failed in its duties.
We want the Election Commission to give a satisfactory answer to why this fraudulent process were being condoned or done, and they are clearly, or they were, complicit to the crime. We see these irregularities have cost us many seats. Particularly those with narrow margin.
UN human rights investigators say they've gathered testimony from casualties of Syria's civil war and medical staff indicating that rebel forces have used the nerve agent sarin. There have been many claims that government forces have used chemical weapons, but the UN Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria says it has not yet seen evidence to substantiate those claims. Now, Commission member Carla Del Ponte says investigators have produced a report which details strong, concrete suspicions, but not yet incontrovertible proof of the use of sarin gas by opposition forces rather than President Assad's troops. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has warned against escalating the situation in Syria after Israel struck targets near Damascus on Sunday, targeting what its officials said were Iranian missiles banned for Hezbollah militants. Speaking on a visit to Hong Kong, France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said he understood the reasons for the Israeli attacks but was concerned about where they might lead.
Israel has said that if weapons were to be given to Hezbollah, they will react. Obviously, it's both something that one can understand, and at the same time, it's a risk. Because if the situation and the conflict extends itself to the surrounding countries, the nature of the conflict can be changed.
At least seven people have been killed and dozens more injured in violent clashes between police and Islamist protesters in the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka. Up to 500,000 supporters of a group calling for stronger Islamic policies gathered in the city centre. Local media say the Hefazat-e-Islam hired at least 3,000 vehicles to bring supporters into the city. Crowds blocked main roads, cutting the city off from the rest of the country. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets after rioters set fire to shops and vehicles. Hospitals are reporting that some of the injured had suffered bullet wounds. A Massachusetts funeral home owner says he's struggling to find a graveyard willing to accept the body of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was killed in a shootout with police 4 days after the attack. Peter Stefan, owner of a funeral parlour in Worcester, Massachusetts, says he'll turn to government officials for help if he can't find a resting place for Tsarnaev soon.
The thing is, we have to bury this guy. Whatever it is, whoever he is, in this country, we bury people. I don't care who it is. And that's what I do. And I don't have circumstances to deal with. I can't separate sins from sinners. I can't pick and choose. This is what we do.
Libya's parliament has voted to ban anyone who held a senior position during Colonel Gaddafi's rule from government. The law passed with an overwhelming majority of 164 votes in favour and just 4 against. The move could unseat the Prime Minister and other top officials, regardless of their part in toppling the dictator. Prime Minister Ali Zidane was a diplomat under Gaddafi who defected to the exiled opposition in 1980. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. It's 8:05 here in London and you're tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House, and the time in Tokyo is 16:06. Here it's 8:06 a.m. in London.
And we start the show with the agenda setter. Today, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson tells us the stories we need to know for the following 24 hours. Fiona, hi.
Hello, greetings from Tokyo.
You sound like, now that sounded, I was a little bit late on my cue there for that, wasn't I?
You weren't.
It's all right, but Fiona's there, she's on time, she's on cue. The first thing that you queued up for us to talk about, Fiona, was Japan, China and South Korea taking a, well, sort of trying to sort of see each other across the fog, and they're talking about pollution today. What's the deal? Is China considered the most difficult party to do business with on this?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound too exciting when you hear about a tripartite pollution agreement, but honestly, these three countries don't agree on very much. So they've been meeting yesterday and today, and they're going to put out a statement later today, but three countries agreeing on something that doesn't involve territorial issues. I mean, basically, this year has been very bad for pollution in China. Horrific statistics. Most Chinese cities don't meet any kind of standards. And it started to affect its neighbours very badly. And in February and a bit of March, we had some bad pollution coming across from China. So I think people are realising there needs to be some kind of agreement. And this is one area that maybe that doesn't involve anything too contentious so far that these three countries could agree on. So they're all in Kitakyushu in the southwest of Japan at the moment. I have to say that the Chinese, being a little bit difficult, didn't send their minister for the environment. They sent their vice minister, making a point. Most people think they're making a point about the Senkaku Islands. But the Japanese environment minister and the South Korean environment minister are there.
Is there any genuine spirit of collaboration among these three countries? Not on necessarily on any level whatsoever, but when it comes to pollution in particular, and the fact that they're talking, as you say, is quite astonishing. But the fact that China only sent a deputy, and the fact that Japan and South Korea pretty much have to put up with what they're sent over in the air, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously it's not a great time for regional relations, but, you know, they've said today that there's going to be a panel they're setting up. They're all going to agree. They're going to be talking about exciting things like nitrogen oxide, which is making a huge difference. I mean, you know, in Japan this year, the sort of hot topic has been the PM2.5. These are the very small particles of pollution that have really been causing a lot of problem in China and now affecting Japan. And that's the thing that got people really worried. You started to see people with face masks in the southwest of Japan, and nobody in Japan wants that. I wouldn't say the relations are brilliant, but they do accept that it's something they've just all got to agree on somehow.
And just finally on this one, Fiona, is the Japanese media covering this much? I mean, it's kind of a difficult sell. It's obviously a big, important news story, but it's a tough sell, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a funny time in Japan this week. It's Golden Week. We've had a string of public holidays. Today is another public holiday. You know, it's quite a slow news day. So, in fact, I think it's probably getting a bit more of a bit more play than it would normally, to be quite honest. So I think it's pretty good news for them.
Fiona, let's move on to the continuing issue of Japan and its population woes. I'm looking at a graph. It's an unusual thing for me, but it has a continual downward slope in terms of population, especially the number of children in Japan.
I know this is such an ongoing story in Japan. We keep reaching new lows of children and new highs of pensioners. But the latest figures that came out did show that the population of under 15s has dropped to a record low. It's now just over 16 million, nearly 16.5 million. And as a, you know, as a ratio, it's a very, very low ratio compared to, in fact, it's the lowest among any country with over 40 million people. So, you know, it's what people have been talking about for a long time, that Japan has got to deal with the issue of its increasing numbers of old people and decreasing numbers of children, who will then be the adults who pay for the old people's healthcare in years to come. So it's a big issue for Japan.
And the next thing is Abe has planned to increase maternity leave. It's, it kind of seems slightly pointless if no one's having babies in the first place. But nonetheless, maybe you can tell us about this. This isn't this is about the amount of time you get off work. But I guess there are other problems apparently around this as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, the point is these two issues are related. You know, really, you've got to look at why are people in Japan not having children? I mean, so this is a big issue. One of the issues, one of the reasons it's often cited is that childcare provision is pretty poor here. And the rate of women going back to work after having children is spectacularly high or spectacularly low, depending on your perspective here. But 70% of women who have children don't go back to work here. And you've got a very highly educated population. It's crazy. It doesn't really make any sense until you get into the system and you realize there just aren't enough places, nursery places for children. It's very difficult for women to go back to work. So Abe's proposals that maternity leave should be extended to 3 years haven't really gone down that well. I think most people feel, well, that's slightly missing the point. The problems are when women go back to work, if they go back to work. It's not about maternity leave. It's about what do they do when they go back to work? There just aren't enough nursery places. What's he going to do about that?
How much is this a cultural issue and how much is this an economic issue?
You know, it's a bit of both. I mean, there are all sorts of statistics about what it would mean for Japan's GDP if these women who don't go back to work, if they did go back to work, it would be great for the economy. So it is an economic issue, definitely. I think there is certainly a cultural issue as well. It's just become quite normal for women, even when they get married, to stop working. But definitely once they have children, you know, it's got really, really low rates of returning to work. And, you know, it's a shame for Japan. There are plenty of women who would be, you know, ideal to be going back to work. They find they go back, they're not given the same job. And then you have the other issue, which is there are very, very few Japanese women in executive positions. So in some ways, there's no incentive to go back. So it's deeply ingrained, I think.
I'm thinking of that lovely kind of, I guess it's a school behind the office that you're talking to us from, the Tokyo Bureau. There's that wonderful kind of playing field and stuff out the back. I kind of feel that's a great place to dump your kids, right? I guess they're the lucky ones, aren't they, Fiona?
I mean, that is perfect spot, isn't it? I mean, I love that school, apart from in the summer when they're practicing, the marching band season starts and we get it full force in the office. And they've got the drums going all afternoon. Delightful things that they are. No, I mean, that school is unusual. These schools in the centre of Tokyo are fewer now and some of them are closing, you know, and this is what's going to happen as the population of young people decreases.
And we should end on Golden Week. We mentioned it at the beginning. Maybe you can paint us a bit of a picture that is not just about traffic congestion and crazy busy airports. Maybe you can tell us the point of it and the beginning and end of it.
Well, I mean, Golden Week is a series. It's a string of public holidays. It's run over a week. It's a very unusual thing. Basically, you have four public holidays strung out, and it's based to encourage Japanese people to take holidays. They don't like to take holidays. They worry they're inconveniencing their co-workers. So everyone goes on holiday at the same time, which is obviously insanity. It means everywhere is really overcrowded. Everything becomes very expensive. And where our office is on lovely Omotesando, you know, I came into the office. It was 8:30 in the morning. I thought, oh, a nice quiet walk to the office. There were already hundreds of people queuing up for Hawaiian pancake places on one side, even Starbucks. There's a massive, massive queue. So they're out spending money, which is the point. So this is the end of Golden Week. We had Children's Day yesterday, which is carried through as a public holiday today to celebrate children and hope they have a long life.
Yeah, I mean, you're making me feel hungry as well, those Hawaiian pancakes.
What, for children?
Not for children, for Hawaiian pancakes. I want to know what's in one of those. For the time being, Fiona, we're going to leave you to your second breakfast then. As you know, it's kind of dinner time,
isn't
it?
It's tea time.
It's tea time.
It's tea time. In the meantime, we will dream of Hawaiian. What is, actually, Fiona, if you're still there, what is a Hawaiian pancake?
Well, I mean, it's become a huge fad. I think I should maybe write something about it. on either side of the street our office is on, we've got a Hawaiian pancake joint on both sides. I mean, who knows what a Hawaiian pancake place is? Basically pancakes are served by people in Hawaiian shirts, and it's going down a storm in Tokyo, and you just have to open one up and you've got a massive queue on the street. So I'm thinking about it. Part-time job.
Now, why didn't I think of that? I'm such an idiot. Fiona Rielsen in Tokyo, thank you very much as ever for joining us. Coming up, Mahmoud Abbas is in China at the invitation of Xi Jinping. We'll take the chance to look at China's ongoing relationship with Palestine. Stay with us.
A 10-minute drive from downtown Hong Kong is an industrial estate that has evolved into a neighborhood. Monocle Films goes inside its warehouse towers to discover artists, designers, and retailers, creating a community.
At the moment, we are making it the place that we would like it to be by bringing the people that we think are adding value to the area.
A cinematic portrait of Chai Wan, Hong Kong's industrial wasteland turned good. Now playing in the Films menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House. There's going to be rather a lot of laundry done in the Chinese presidential residence in the next few days. This weekend, Beijing played host to the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. No sooner will Mr. Abbas have left, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will arrive for talks. The two leaders are unlikely to meet, but what does the closeness of their visits say about China?
Although the Chinese have always traditionally supported the existence of Palestinian statehood, Beijing has traditionally played a very low-key role in Middle Eastern affairs. But are we witnessing a more proactive approach to the international diplomatic circuit? Joining us now is Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, China expert and Monocle 24 regular. He joins us in the studio. Many thanks for coming in, Raffaella. Just explain to us the purpose of Mahmoud Abbas's visit to Beijing.
Well, I mean, the purpose seems to be the Chinese, very quickly after the Xi Jinping administration came into power, they extended formal invitations to both Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, both of whom have come to China at exactly the same time. Well, they say that they orchestrated this on purpose and the decision was made. Now, they've done the whole sort of choreography of the trip very carefully. So the two men are never in the same city at the same time. So this sort of awkward encounter will never happen unless they say, you know, the two leaders would like to meet, in which case they'd be delighted to facilitate it. It turns out I don't think they've actually elected to meet. And so the two are just sort of going to pass each other in the air. The specifics of each meeting on a sort of bilateral level seem to be different. From a Palestinian side, Mahmoud Abbas seems very eager to try to develop economic cooperation with the Chinese, and he's walked away with a number of agreements, the details of which have not been released yet. In economic fields, I know he'd been speaking about getting some investment in electricity beforehand. And then also in the cultural field, they've signed some sort of cultural exchange programs. On the Israeli side, it's a much more... It's a much more complicated relationship in many ways. The Israelis, the Chinese always are very eager to get Israeli technology. Israeli defense technology in particular is something that they're very eager to sort of attract, and they've attracted a lot of investment from the Israelis in this direction. And then also in the broader security terms, they are, we've had a very senior visit of a senior intelligence official on the Israeli side about 2 weeks prior to Benjamin Netanyahu's visit. And during that, they spoke a bit about Iran and Syria and some of the other Middle Eastern questions that the Israelis are very concerned about and would like the Chinese to be more involved in.
It is that problem, though. We'll go back to the Palestinian-Israeli issue in a minute. But as you just mentioned, Iran and Syria are two subjects which China in particular, sticks on in terms of the rest of the world. Mm. And Israel is obviously desperate to get its teeth into Syria. Yes. And Iran as well, especially with Syria, we've seen this last weekend. Yes. What kind of relationship does China therefore have with Israel? I mean, how much is Benjamin Netanyahu actually going to be going to China to give them a bit of a shake?
Well, I think that's probably quite a good way of characterising it. I think the Israelis are very eager for the Chinese to be more on side on these issues. And so I know that on the Iran side, for example, a lot of their visits are basically them presenting their intelligence. I'm saying, this is what we know the Iranians are doing. This is why you should be doing more to support us in trying to get the Iranians to deal with this. The Chinese are, of course, massive consumers of Iranian hydrocarbons and quite heavily invested in the Iranian economy. On the Syria side of the equation, it's a different picture because there, you know, the Chinese are probably less forward in international terms on this issue. It's very much the Russians who are at the sort of forefront of UNSC resolution, sort of blocking any further movement on Syria. But the Chinese are quite worried about the sort of escalating situation that they've seen there. And they have over the past year tried to do more in diplomatic terms to try to help bring resolution. I wondered about how big a booking these two guys are for a new Chinese premiere, Raffaella. Like getting these two guys together, not getting them together, but getting them at least in kind of series order, one after the other in Beijing. Mm-hmm. Does this matter to Xi Jinping and the sort of Chinese idea of him as a statesman?
Well, I think there is the sort of hot word, the buzzword at the moment in Chinese diplomacy is this concept of constructive interference. They're trying to move beyond their non-interference terminology, which used to be the sort of keyword of, you know, Chinese foreign policy, which is basically don't interfere, don't get involved in anything, just sort of stand back and say, oh yes, you know, we just sort of manage the situation. They're now trying to figure out ways of how can they actually contribute positively to this, and they put this under constructive interference. But they're still not very sure how to do this. And I think this is why you've seen this event happen in this very sort of carefully choreographed way. They invite both the leaders there. There obviously is a deep hope on their side that maybe the leaders, decide, oh, we should meet while we're in China. But on the other hand, they don't push the issue. You know, they let it sort of happen and they let everyone get around everyone's diplomatic things. And I think this is about the new Xi Jinping administration trying to figure out what its more forward-looking diplomatic role can be in the world.
And building on that, the fact that China is, you know, would be awfully happy, I would imagine, if suddenly Abbas and Netanyahu said, yes, we want to meet, let's do it in Beijing. To what degree would that be a real snub to Washington, which of course a few months ago decided that Obama wanted to take an active role in trying to push some sort of peace process?
I think it would. I'm not sure who the snub would be from in many ways. I think I don't think the Chinese would perceive it or be driving it as a snub towards Washington. However, I think in terms of the Israelis and the Palestinians, it probably would be, from their perspective, a snub to Washington. The fact that they would now be going to a different international player to be the sort of broker in their affairs. I would emphasize that I think we're still at an early stage yet, and we're nowhere near that yet. I think the Chinese still haven't quite figured out exactly what they would do. They've got their ambassadors who are now running around the Middle East a lot more actively, trying to go and sort of make discussions, to talk to people, to meet with people, to organize meetings, which is evidence of a sort of advanced diplomacy. However, what I don't think they've quite figured out yet is how you turn this sort of activity into result. That's the part where they're still trying to figure it out.
It is quite an interesting area, though, because it's not something that people would think of automatically as being a good forum for very sensitive discussion to take place. Are we perhaps underestimating the fact that this is a new approach that, okay, we're not expecting miracles, but there's so much history and baggage with the United States when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, to actually say no, we're going to go to Beijing, we're going to start this all again. It's fresh.
It's possible. I mean, the thing to also say is that, you know, the Chinese have traditionally had quite contentious relations with the two sides. I mean, if we go back to the Cold War, of course, the Chinese, I think, were the first non-Arab state to recognize the PLO. Internationally. And this was part of their sort of supporting of, South-South cooperation and supporting insurgent movements around the world. They only actually recognized they only sort of established formal diplomatic relations with Israel 20 years ago. So, you know, it's relatively recent, their sort of connections with these two countries. And that does suggest that maybe these relations are still at a very superficial level. And so if we would push deeper, that would be required to get to the sort of advanced state of diplomatic discussions where you're talking about resolution. I think you'd end up digging into some holes that may, in fact, awaken problems.
All right, OK. We shall bear that in mind then. Raffaella Pantucha-Ezawa, thank you very much indeed for joining us here in the studio. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 23 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in a moment where we head to Hong Kong.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
May is a busy month in Hong Kong as the city gears up for its first instalment of Art Basel, which kicks off on the 23rd of the month. To get into the mood, we've lined up a week of cultural stories from Hong Kong here on Monocle 24.
Kicking it off today is a chat with the man behind Salon 10, a bar in the middle of the city that's providing a bolt hole for many in Hong Kong's cultural scene. Our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, met with Ellis Kruger and Alex Day to find out why their space has been such a success.
Walk around Hong Kong's Central District on any weekend night, and you'll quickly get a sense of what's on offer for nightlife in this part of town. The patrons of loud clubs and bars pour out on the street in varying states of sobriety, while local police try to keep the traffic moving. If it's mind-numbing music and expensive table service you're after, venturing into one of these spots will suit you well. But if you're in search of a good cocktail and a more intimate night out, head a little bit above the fray to Salon 10, a lounge bar that has become somewhat of a clubhouse for much of Hong Kong's creative community. Here, Alex Day and Ellis Kruger, who by day work as bespoke tailors, host guests in what feels more like a well-decorated living room than a commercial bar. Ellis explains how the space came about.
Salon 10 is a cocktail bar with a very whimsical speakeasy vibe. It's billed as a members club, and we don't have official members, but we allow in people who we think will appreciate the space and we will appreciate. I guess our involvement began a year ago. We have a cabaret night called The Bearded Lady, which is a time travel nightclub. Each time we pick a different year in a different place and we celebrate it through burlesque, magic, music, band. And that became very popular. No one really used to go to Salon 10 before. It was this hidden, forgotten little jewel. So the owner, who's a partner, once our parties became popular, asked us to become full-time partners and to manage it. And so we did. And we've been doing that really since September last year, full-time.
It looks a little bit like a ship, kind of rounded walls, Art Nouveau-inspired furniture. There's a large mural that everyone comments on and loves. It's a conversation starter. It's in the style of Rousseau, but the main figure is E.T. And it's the brainchild of our partner, who redecorated it after his family had run it as a restaurant for some time. And it's just very cozy, clubby, soft chairs, banquets, low lighting. Everyone looks very attractive in low lighting. So people love it because they look so good when they're there. Yeah, I think it's colorful. It's just weird. It's not something that you see in Hong Kong so much.
What Alex describes is true. It's not only Salon 10's design, which is odd to Hong Kong. It's also that the space has multiple uses. With an open kitchen, a fold-down movie screen, and a piano, Salon 10 hosts everything from family-style lunches to film nights and music performances. It's something that Hong Kongers, many of whom live in tiny apartments, have clearly been craving.
We have a Sunday lunch program, which is every 2 or 3 weeks, where we find a chef who specializes in a certain cuisine. So the last one was Indonesian. So they made Indonesian food, and then we have live music. After lunch, everyone eats family style around big tables, and then we show a film that relates to the food, and then we have more live music. So it goes from like 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the evening. You spend all Sunday, and you kind of immerse yourself in like family style eating and cooking and live music and cinema. And we wanted to do something in the daytime that was equal to what we do with the Bearded Lady, and we knew lots of great chefs. There wasn't really this kind of, there's a lot of private kitchens in Hong Kong, but they tend to be a bit stiff and a bit formal, or only big enough to go with a group of friends. And we have 40 people who come to lunch, so we wanted, you know, you to come and also meet people and sort of exchange ideas and be sort of inspired by the food and the cinema and the music. And since we have a full kitchen there, we were like, well, why not?
I think that Hong Kong already has this kind of private club culture. So this is something people are very interested in already. But like you said, people's apartments are small, so it's also quite different to the normal experience of Hong Kong. It's somewhere that you can relax. By now, the people that are coming there are very friendly with one another. You can turn up with yourself and probably run into 5 or 6 people you know, and really stay there for the night. I think the general mood or vibe of most nightclubs here is unbearable to stay for more than like 30 minutes unless you're dancing or deaf.
So I think the reason why the salon's been so successful is it made a kind of home environment where you could come, and it's not just a bar. You can, there's performance going on, there's lunch, there's films, there's all kinds of things happening there, and it is very homely. I mean, we spend most of our time on busy nights. The bar area is kind of like the kitchen area. It's like the classic thing that at parties, people always want to hang out in the kitchen. You know, we're always shooing people. It's like this natural gravitation towards the kitchen. It's a location that allows people to do what they would normally do in other cities if they I had a larger apartment.
Already popular, Will Salon 10 have to work hard to maintain the cozy atmosphere that it's managed to cultivate. Alex and Ellis seem to have the formula sorted, and it's not about who is going to buy the most expensive bottle.
We have a door policy. I mean, it's quite a strict door policy. Everyone is welcomed and said farewell to at the door. And if you're not a regular or you don't come with regulars, we do have a certain top secret criteria how we pick and choose. But basically, our rule is if all the tables are filled and all the spots at the bar are filled, then we don't let in any more people. So it's sort of like one in, one out. And we've just found that financially, that is not that much different than letting everyone in, because barmen can only make so many drinks and then you can't get to the bar. And so keeping it a little bit controlled, like Alex says, is actually financially better over the long run and a much better experience for the customer.
Mixing a relaxed environment with diverse cultural programming, Salon 10 occupies a special place in Hong Kong. And in a city where domestic space comes at a premium, it's a place that many will want to call their home away from home. Thankfully, with Ellis and Alex making sure that there are only as many guests as there are seats, it won't ever get too crowded. For Monocle, in Hong Kong, I'm Aisha Spears.
That was Alex Day and Ellis Kruger speaking to our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. And tomorrow the series continues, where our Hong Kong team meets the island's most famous tattoo artist.
In the next half hour of today's programme, we'll be meeting the author Jasper Gibson, whose debut novel examines middle-aged life in Venezuela. And we'll also find out what's on the agenda in today's monologue.
In the 1990s, the U.S. attempted to buy back, rather unsuccessfully, all the unused missiles, fearing they would land in the lap of anti-American fighters. And then, of course, came 9/11, when the Mujahideen's descendants, the Taliban, and their al-Qaeda guests became enemy number one.
We'll hear a little more from Daniel Giacopelli a little later on. Plus, we'll rifle through the Brazilian newspapers too. But first, with the time just about to nudge 32 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world headlines now from Barney.
Thanks, Emma. Malaysia's opposition leader has condemned Sunday's election victory by the ruling Barisan Nasional. Anwar Ibrahim says the election was fraudulent and the Election Commission failed in its duties. UN human rights investigators say they've gathered testimony which indicates that rebel forces in Syria have used the nerve agent sarin. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has warned against escalating the situation in Syria after Israel struck targets near Damascus on Sunday, targeting what its officials said were Iranian missiles bound for Hezbollah militants. At least seven people have been killed and dozens more injured in violent clashes between police and Islamist protesters in the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka. Up to 500,000 supporters of a group calling for stronger Islamic policies gathered in the city centre. A Massachusetts funeral home owner says he's struggling to find a graveyard willing to accept the body of the Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamal Antsanayev, who was killed in a shootout with police 4 days after the attack. Libya's parliament has voted to ban anyone who held a senior position during Colonel Gaddafi's rule from government. The law was passed with an overwhelming majority of 164 votes in favour and just four against. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Emma Nelson.
Now here's a name to watch. Jasper Gibson has built a career out of comedy. Now he's turning to writing novels. Set in Caracas, A Bright Moon for Fools tells the tale of Harry Agapanthus Christmas, a 58-year-old career liar who channels the spirit of Oliver Reed and who likes to wear red trousers.
Nothing wrong with any of that. Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Jasper in the studio and asked him about his book.
Your book tells a story about Harry Christmas. Can you describe him for us?
Harry Christmas is part Jim Royle, part Oliver Reed, part Ignatius P. Riley. He's an aging, formidable man who has never, ever got over the death of his wife and finds himself crashing around rural Venezuela, getting into serious trouble. That's how I'd sum him up.
What's the connection with Venezuela?
The truth is that there comes a moment in everyone's life when the most mature decision you can take is to run away. And that's what I did. I chose Caracas out of a list of destinations for no other reason than I liked the sound of the word. I didn't know anything about the country or the town. And as soon as I booked my ticket, then people started telling me horror stories about it. But when I got there, you know, really from day one, I fell in love with the people, fell in love with the place. If you can imagine being in a traffic jam on the motorway, nobody's moving, people are leaning out of their cars, shouting to each other. The message comes back that you're not going anywhere for a couple of hours, and spontaneously all the cars' doors fly open, the people start mixing drinks, dancing in the street, and you're suddenly in the longest, thinnest salsa party you've ever been in. You know, from that day, I was completely hooked.
And I agree with you. I love the sound of Caracas. You know,
it's a great word.
So you just went there and then you got inspired to write this novel.
Yes, that's right. That traffic jam was taking me to a beach town called Choroní. I made some friends there quite instantly, handed me a bottle of this stuff called Guarapite. I don't know if they have that in Brazil, but it tastes...
Don't have that, but I would like to try it.
It tastes just like fruit juice. Pretty much 3 days later, I kind of woke up without any shoes and with some makeup on. And I was on a beach surrounded by pretty physically perfect people, a pale and alien specimen cast away. The idea of Harry Christmas was born from that, really.
They love those kind of Miss competitions, right, in Venezuela. I think they're the biggest country in the world for those kind of things.
I mean, I've never seen more breast enhancement than in Caracas. It's like everybody's in training for Miss Venezuela. Yeah, it's quite incredible.
Men as well?
Men as well. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And tell me more, what are your thoughts on the country? I mean, I read somewhere that people either love it or hate it. Even Venezuelans themselves, sometimes they describe it as hell. Oh, my God, and it's terrible. Or others say it's a socialist paradise. What are your views on that? Well,
I mean, I think that is a sort of false dichotomy, really. That's the impression you get from the images we receive about Caracas, that, you know, you're either pro-Chavez or anti-Chavez, you're either desperately poor, extremely rich, and it all seems about that polarity. And that is the case in Caracas. But outside of Caracas, which is obviously the vast, vast majority of the country, I didn't find that polarity. I found more a wonderful mix of races and cultures and landscapes, and I think it's a real shame that people have that impression of it, because it's not like that.
Especially the international media as well, when you read about Venezuela, especially Chavez, it's very polarized, the opinions and everything. Either you're kind of for him or against him, with very strong opinions.
Right, and as soon as I got to Venezuela, in my first few days there, I met an English guy who'd been living there for 15 years, and I asked him what he thought of Chavez. Was he a good thing or a bad thing? And he said to me, the only position that I found, an honest position about Chavez, is with the Chavistas, I'm anti-Chavez. And with anti-Chavez people, I'm a Chavista. And I think that really says a lot.
And let's talk about your novel as well. And it's the first novel from the publisher Inside the Dog.
Yes.
And that's very exciting. And
yep.
They have a background in music industry. Which approach are they trying to reach their audience? Is it a different one, maybe because of their background?
I think so. I mean, I think Crispin Somerville, who is from a music background now and runs Lily Allen's record label, has been through the sort of end of the world apocalypse that the music industry was in for the last few years, and has learned some valuable lessons. And he can see that publishing is going through the same sort of fear, really, and because things are changing. And what they're trying to do, I think, Inside the Dog is really combine the very best of old-fashioned publishing, and by that I mean three-hour, incredibly boozy lunches, with a passion for the physical book and how it looks, and a willingness to take risks on stuff and not just publish, you know, celebrity memoirs and teenagers that live in space or whatever, with the advantages of what is happening in the internet and being able to reach a very big, active audience online.
That's why Crispin said that he's taking like a punk rock approach to all of this, right?
Right, right.
You're the first one.
Right. Well, you know, I'm very honored to be so. It is possible to do things while the slow, big monsters of publishing are having trouble. You know, the small, nimble operator can live and do well, I hope. You know, one of the great things about working with Inside the Dog is that they let me have quite a lot of control about how the book looked. I've been a long-time fan of Soundway Records, who do amazing reissues of Latin American and African music. I've now signed contemporary bands, and their records always looked amazing. So I got in contact with them to find out really who the designer of their records, who's a guy called Luis Jerez, And this is the first book he's done. And I, you know, luckily for me, he liked the book. And I think it shows. It looks really good.
And Jasper, I just would like to say, of course, mention you're the co-founder of The Poke. What are your next projects? Do you want to expand on The Poke, or do you have projects for another novel already?
I'm definitely going to keep, you know, writing novels, and have got a project for another novel. I'm not going to tell you anything about that. And, you know, as far as The Poke's concerned, we just hope to keep growing. It was set up to be a sort of base for UK internet native comic talent. And we just want to keep on doing that and championing the best of the new comic talent that's out there.
And that was the author Jasper Gibson speaking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier on. And fans of Fernando will be pleased to know that in just a little while he'll be back live in the studio to go through the Brazilian newspapers. He is, by all accounts, dressed top to toe in white and wearing shorts. Are you ready for that, Robert?
That's wasted on the radio, isn't it?
It's not.
Maybe he's doing.
Let the imagination run wild.
Maybe he's doing something afterwards. Like playing tennis. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to review some of the arts on display at Berlin's Gallery Weekend.
Istanbul is at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, and Monocle 24 is heading there for two very special shows. On Tuesday, May 7 and Wednesday, May 8, we'll be broadcasting live from the rooftop of the George Hotel in the company of some of Turkey's most influential leaders. Mark your calendars and tune into The Globalist on May 7 and May 8. That's at 8 a.m. Istanbul time, 6 a.m. here in London, and 1400 hours in Tokyo. The Globalist, live from Istanbul, in association with GE.
All right, you're tuned into Midori House. It's 8:41 here in London. And for this week's culture preview, we're in Berlin. The Gallery Weekend was initiated by a small group of the city's gallerists 9 years ago. It was meant to lure out-of-town collectors to Berlin, a place where plenty of artists were working, but not enough collectors were living.
By showing work in the artists' home galleries, however, not in cramped art fair booths, longer-term relationships between artists, dealers and buyers can be forged. And a nice side effect of this is that Gallery Weekend showcases the best of Berlin's art world on a gorgeous spring weekend every single year. It took place recently. Kimberly Bradley was there.
Swinging from the ceiling at the newly renovated gallery Eigenen Art in Berlin is a magnetic pendulum, a magnificent piece by German artist Karsten Nicolai. It's on view at Gallery Weekend Berlin, an art event running from April 26th to 28th, with 51 galleries showing mostly one-person works in 66 venues around the city. Gallery Weekend Berlin has grown from 33 venues and has also increased in cachet and visitor numbers. It's grown so much that last year, the organizing galleries appointed a CEO, the Frenchman and Centre Pompidou alumnus Cédric Aurel. He explains why his position was created.
On the one hand, they decided to create this position because it's a lot of work to do and they have their own business to run on a daily basis, and working on the gallery weekend, it's a lot of work. It's a commitment. And they have to run their own business. On the other hand, it's a statement, which means the whole project is becoming more institutional.
One of the founding gallerists, Guido Bauda, is showing artist Thilo Heinzmann's styrofoam and nail polish works in his new space on Potsdamer Straße, currently the main art drag of the city. Bauda's gallery is situated in the former editorial offices of the Tagesspiegel newspaper. Collectors come through asking about the pieces. Taking a break to talk, Baurach explains how popular Gallery Weekend has grown amongst gallerists.
I think, you know, you can just hear it from the colleagues. Everybody wants to do or participate in Gallery Weekend. At Gallery Weekend, you have to pay money for. I guess it's around 7,500 euros if you want to participate. The fact that all galleries in Berlin want to participate on Gallery Weekend means that it is successful. They would not pay money for something that does not bring the money back. So we have a wonderful group of international collectors, curators, critics, artists coming to town for this event and see the gallery shows. Because it's, you know, the idea was to do something that is not an art fair. to bring the people back in the galleries. And you see that worldwide now, other cities try to do something like this, do a gallery weekend too. I guess there was Paris, Vienna is doing it, New York was trying it, but it's over already. But lots of cities trying to do the same, so I guess it's a very successful model of how to bring back people in the galleries.
A much-discussed recent article by New York critic Jerry Saltz was all about how no one goes to galleries anymore. But Gallery Week in Berlin proves the opposite. An estimated 10,000 people visited, ranging from avid locals to VIP guests. Some shows are blockbusters, like neon works by Joseph Kosuth at Spreutmachers, or the powerful paintings of 93-year-old Austrian artist Maria Lasnik at Kapitän Petzl Gallery. It's a lot of work to keep up with it all.
So it's been running very smoothly, thanks to this shuttle from BMW, which allows us to join all the galleries. There are 51 galleries in Berlin, so it's quite a challenge to see everything. But I think that the idea is not to try to see everything, but to have his own selection. Because when you have 50 galleries showing art from the end of the 19th century, like Medardo Rosso at Kunsthandel, Wolfgang Werner, through Isabella Bortolozzi, who's showing very young artist Oscar Murillo, you have a very large choice.
About 40% of the solo shows spotlight women artists, some of them rising stars like Anna K.E., or Serbian artist Aleksandar Domanović, whose sculptures at Tanya Leighton Gallery are haunting reminders of one of the first prosthetic devices, the Belgrade hand. Like many others, Domanović is based in Berlin. Now that the city is getting so slick, however, will the artists stay?
I can't say. The question is where to go. That is the big question. You know, because still, even this year it gets gentrified here, it will be, I can't imagine it will ever look like London, or it will ever look like Paris. And where you want to go, what is an interesting city to go? So some artists, they go to Brussels since a couple of years, because Brussels is a nice place, not too expensive. You are fast in London, you have a great airport, you come everywhere, but it's a small city, and it's a little bit too small. And I guess you stay in Brussels for maybe 2 years, 3 years, but not longer. Here in Berlin, you also have the possibility, and a lot of artists do move to the countryside and stay there. And I think a lot of artists will stay, and still they're coming, lots of artists. The question is always where to go. For me, there's only one other place in the world where you go as an artist. This is Los Angeles.
One artist actually is from Los Angeles. Alex Israel shows around 20 oversized, brightly colored self-portraits in the vast new spaces of Perez Projects.
Well, this is the first time I'm showing a new body of work. The works are all self-portraits. They were all made in 2013, and they get fabricated at Warner Brothers Studios in Burbank, California. I live in Los Angeles, and so that's where I make a lot of my work. They are made of fiberglass, and they're painted with airbrushed acrylic paint.
Why do you make them at Warner Brothers?
Well, I like the idea of working within the Hollywood system. I grew up in Los Angeles, and that's the system that fuels the city. And it's also the source of the entertainment culture that has been disseminated around the world. So it's right there in my backyard. And as an artist who's interested in entertainment and popular culture, I like the idea that I get to work right in the middle of it.
It's a bit ironic that something so literally Hollywood is being exhibited on Karl Marx Allee.
Well, I think that there's definitely a foreignness to this work in this city. Not only in color palette, but also perhaps in the accessibility and kind of pop commerciality of the work. And I like the idea of bringing that to the street that is named after Mr. Marx.
It's hard to say what Marx would have thought of the Gallery Weekend gala dinner. More than 1,000 people meet in Kraftwerk, a massive riverside power plant. Amidst the raw concrete, metal pillars and peeling paint is plenty of glamour. Guests include important curators, art fair directors, museum directors, critics, collectors, gallerists, and of course artists. But beyond sales, how important is Gallery Week in Berlin on the art circuit and in the big scheme of things?
I think it's great that there's a condensed weekend of events that bring everybody together. It's like Oscar Week in LA.
For Monocle, In Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And if you've just tuned in, that was a little preview of what's to come in tonight's Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. That's on 1900 hours UK time. And elsewhere on the show, we'll chat to Stephen Budd of Africa Express, hear from the Toronto-based director of a new film called The Defector. And there's live music from Korean band Gunam, who rock. And it's time, as you may have been able to tell by the music ringing in your ears, for the Brazilian Paper Review with our resident Brazilian journalist, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, welcome to the show this morning.
Hello, Rob.
Bright
Hello,
and early
Emma.
And fresh.
Exactly.
And as billed, all in white, right?
And yeah, absolutely, sort of packet crisp. Straight exactly. out of the packet.
That's
Amazing.
How we dress for New Year in Brazil, so that's it's a fresh, fresh
dress,
start.
Don't dress like that for New Year in London.
if you dress black in Brazil, that means you're being a little bit of a radical.
Really? Is that how you dress in New Year?
All white.
Because apparently in Italy, you have to, if you're a girl especially, you have to wear red knickers on New Year's Eve.
Oh, in Brazil as well. But
really?
just knickers, not the clothes.
You just wear knickers on in Brazil?
No, sorry.
Just that's amazing.
The knickers are red and the rest is white.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that can...
Or if you want money, it can be yellow as well.
I don't think I could
you
do
can potentially
yellow.
See red knickers through something white. Is this how you That's know that everyone wears red knickers?
That's absolutely. Well, there may be other ways too, Robert, finding out.
I know.
In Brazil, do you have to throw your red knickers away the next morning? Because in Italy, you have to.
I think so. I mean, you shouldn't wear it again.
You shouldn't wear it
especially
again.
Especially if you're on such an important occasion, you know.
It is an important
That's my
occasion.
Opinion. That's my opinion.
And why it warrants red knickers. Anyway, the
why
papers.
Red knickers?
I don't know. And I actually have a funny feeling that I was duped by an Italian woman one day who told me that I had to wear red knickers on New Year's Eve.
It's the colour of passion, guys.
I've yet to
wear. Right. Okay.
I've yet to meet another Italian who actually wears red knickers on New Year's Eve, but I have steadfastly followed this routine that my friend Manuela once told me to do. And it, you know, every year you have to go out and buy the red knickers.
Oh, so it has to be a new pair and they have to be bought on New Year's Eve.
Has
and
to be brand
a,
new
there's
knickers,
a rigmarole. There's
worn
a thing.
Once, chucked in the bin the next day.
Okay.
And Manuela was saying that this is my delightful friend who's telling me that she always got sort of proper Dolce & Gabbana, you know,
yeah.
posh knickers. Posh red knickers.
Do they have to be, I mean, is there a style of, I mean, you don't want kind of knickerbockers, do they? They have to be a sexy knicker.
Well, frankly, there's nothing wrong with a red knickerbocker, Rob. There's much to be said on New Year's Eve for a red knickerbocker.
All
anyway.
Right, okay.
Anyway.
This, by the way, is a great introduction.
That's
doing the Brazilian.
That's our Brazilian newspaper review.
Yeah,
knickers, red knickers.
Brings out the red knickers in everyone.
It all
this kind
started
of
with Faye and his white shorts. So if you will dress like that, Faye, that's only to be expected. So let's turn to serious matters. The cover of the Folha de São Paulo. What's going on here then?
Let's start there. There's an interesting poll that Folha de São Paulo did. That there's a new project in Brazil that aimed to limit the benefits of a half and try for students and the over 60s. And that's quite a huge thing in Brazil because cultural events like cinema or theatre are incredibly expensive in São Paulo. Actually, according to this poll, 68% of the population of São Paulo agree with me. So basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to limit to 40% the number of tickets sold that are half entry. For
So they're giving the money off to less people rather than making it less money off.
Exactly, yeah. Because sometimes if you go, there's a recent statistics as well, like any kind of cinema session or a concert, 70% of the tickets are half entry. So that's why the owners, they put the price so high, because even the half price will still be a little bit expensive. So in my opinion, it is a good thing. And I think it will make cultural events more accessible in Brazil. And it's a very important thing. That's why it's on the front page.
It does strike me as being strange that it is on the front page, but you say it has a very important cultural significance. To what degree do the current prices actually stop people from going to the cinema or to the theatre?
I think it does stop. I mean, I think in Brazil, for example, I've been living here in London. The tickets, if you go to cinema in São Paulo, is the same price as London. So you can imagine, but we have totally different lifestyles. The standard of living here in London is much higher as well. So how can you have the same price in São Paulo? You know, of course, Brazil is growing, our economy is improving and everything. But for me, it's one of the most expensive cities in the world. And I'm not. There's been recent research about that, saying the Rio and São Paulo are very expensive, even for tourists.
And what's the Folha de São Paulo as a newspaper? Where does that tend to stand on this? What's the readership of that paper? Is that younger people that might be in favor of this, or is it a more traditional newspaper?
Well, It is kind of a slightly center-left paper, but of course the readership is a little bit elitist. Probably they are not hugely affected by that, you know, because people who read broadsheets in Brazil are kind of, well, in general, like middle classes or whatever. They have the money. So, but they are worried. They actually wrote in the editorial there, they totally agree with this new project that actually was approved by the Congress last month. So I think it's a good thing, and maybe people will go more to the cinema in Brazil.
And very, very briefly, if you may, Faye, there's one tiny little story about the Brazilian underground system. Undergrounds are generally very, very good for getting absolutely every walk of life to use it, but this is now changing.
It is now changing, and it's quite an interesting thing, because 10 years ago, the upper middle class and the rich people in Brazil, they used to say, oh, the Brazilian underground is great, you know, and they used to go there. But actually, from now, actually, they stopped doing that, and they're using more their cars, because the underground is kind of expanding, and there's many people there, and it's not as comfortable as it used to be. But yeah, that's the main news in Brazil.
Faye, thank you very much indeed for bringing the news and your shorts into the studio.
And close the show. It's time now for today's monologue. Our producer, Danny Giacopelli, looks to the unintended consequences of military intervention.
They didn't expect the big guns. They hoped for rifles, maybe. For AK-47s. Cheap, accurate, and mean. Trusty numbers that did the job. And the Americans were more than happy to oblige. After all, stacked up against them, said President Jimmy Carter, was the greatest threat to peace since the Second World War. So big guns, or rather missiles, were what the Mujahideen got in the 1980s. Stingers, about 2,000 of them. Heat-seeking, aircraft-smashing, and shoulder-fired. As a military plan, Operation Cyclone was a wild success. In the hands of the lightly armed insurgents, the Stingers plucked dozens of Soviet choppers from the sky, forcing the Kremlin to eventually leave behind the blood and the tears and the burned-out hardware in Central Asia. But as anyone who watched the film Charlie Wilson's War knows, the plot was somewhat lost after the Mission Accomplished banner was unfurled and the post-war plan was tucked away in a subterranean Pentagon closet, a la an arc in a certain Spielberg movie. And because of that short-sightedness, and because of the Stinger's deadliness, and because, perhaps, of Murphy's Law, things took a turn for the worse. In the 1990s, the U.S. attempted to buy back, rather unsuccessfully, all the unused missiles, fearing they would land in the lap of anti-American fighters. And then, of course, came 9/11, when the Mujahideen's descendants, the Taliban, and their al-Qaeda guests became enemy number one. It's a story of unintended consequences, known in intelligence circles as blowback. Arm a group to the teeth to bring down your rival, mix and stir, and that group could soon turn against you. Remember this when considering Syria. At a recent press conference, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel admitted that the Americans may rethink its stance on arming the Syrian rebels, that amorphous and ideological incoherent group fighting the goons of Bashar al-Assad. This is unwise. 2 years of a desperate and angry struggle against the government has radicalized vast parts of the rebel force. It now makes up the main chunk of the uprising. And Syria is the destination du jour of the world's most adventurous Islamists. So what to do? The atrocities in Syria are horrendous, and the lack of good, or even remotely good, solutions to the conflict is frightening. One doesn't envy the policymakers whose job it is to solve. Throwing American gunpowder, however, into a smoldering furnace is not the answer. For Monocle, I'm Daniel Giacopelli.
And that's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is a selection of Monocle 24's Great Global Playlist. Andrew Muller will be here with today's briefing. That's at 1300 hours Berlin time, midday here in London. Tom Burgess-Watson and Hugo McDonald will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. And just to let you know that the Globalist will be coming live from the roof of the George Hotel in Istanbul at 8 a.m. Istanbul time, 6 a.m. London time tomorrow. That's Tuesday and Wednesday. But from myself and Robert, goodbye and thank you for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.